Hutton Gibson worked for 24 years. Gosh, he looks so much like his son. Sorry. Look at this. Come on up. He's worked for 24 years on the railroad, was incapacitated by injury. Hutton then moved his family to Australia. He returned to the United States 5 years later. And for the past 35 years, Hutton Gibson has studied the plans for a one-world government and has endeavored to educate his fellow Americans about the tremendous loss of our liberties. Please welcome Hutton Gibson.
It's a 16-point type, but I'm still going to make sure I can see it. I wish to thank Mr. Schultz and we the people for this opportunity to address you. Ladies and gentlemen, in the 20s, if anyone wished to know the value of the pound, mark, franc, dollar, lira, peso, etc., he could in absolute confidence consult an encyclopedia. Now we can't keep up with their value in the twice daily newspapers. Can there be some grand design? Is someone demonstrating that we need a one world currency to preserve stability? 85 years ago ended a terrible war to end all wars, which killed off an entire generation and broke the back of Europe. 20-odd years later, another war killed off another European generation. The world was guided into reaction. Some superpower must be established to contain these catastrophes. So now the UN interferes everywhere, nearly always on the wrong side, or paralyzes troops supposedly under its orders. It is proven unable to stop war. So the message comes through again. The solution is a one-world government. As each level is reached, the individual's control and rights diminish, and what efficiency remains all tends to tyranny. Lately, some of the worst tyrannies have splintered. The communists have demonstrated that one-world atheism, foreign to man's nature, cannot work. So the Catholic Church deteriorates into the required one-world religion, as exemplified in his January 2nd dispatch. From Vatican City, John Paul II rang in the new year with a renewed call for peace in the Middle East and Africa and the creation of a new world order based on respect for the dignity of man and equality among nations. Equality among nations is achieved only at the expense of superior nations. Back to the article. John Paul presided over a morning mass inside St. Peter's Basilica to mark the World Day of Peace, which the Roman Catholic Church celebrates every January 1st. Can we find nothing real to celebrate? John Paul directed his thoughts to continuing conflicts around the globe, but he stressed that to bring about peace, there needs to be a new respect for international law and the creation of a new international order based on the goals of the United Nations. He called for, quote, an order that is able to give adequate solutions to today's problems based on the dignity of the human being, on an integral development of society, on solidarity among the nations rich and poor, on the sharing of resources and the extraordinary results of scientific and technical progress. End of quotation. One would almost expect some lip service to adherence to morality and justice. The source, for too many, assumes the inference of infallibility. This appears rather to follow logically from another papal panegyric of Marxist and Masonic principles. Paul VI's address, United Nations, in October 1965, in which Paul stated, quote, it is the ideal of which mankind dreams on its pilgrimage through time. It is the world's greatest hope, unquote. From a man supposedly heading the religion which is always taught, that the Catholic Church is the world's only hope. Statements like the above, even had they emanated from real popes, cannot be invested with papal infallibility because they fall outside the scope of that privilege. They are neither faith nor morals. They are not found in the deposit of faith, to which papal infallibility is absolutely confined. But everywhere, the experts are ignored. What has happened to Thomas Jefferson's principle that the best governed society is that which is least governed? Or to St. Thomas Aquinas' dictum that the purpose and province of government is protection of the individual, to assure him the freedom necessary to save his soul? No man is free while staggering under a crushing public debt induced by interference with the medium of exchange. A proper function of government is debt-free issue and regulation of money. But most governments have handed this vital and necessary function to the bankers who charge us heavily for our rights. This charge and its huge past accumulations could vanish into the same thin air as our federal government, which criminally surrendered to usurers a power merely delegated by the states. Can we really afford an insane government? No sane government discriminates against and taxes its own citizens for the supposed benefit of foreigners. Nor can such lunacy be accidental or the fruit of the massive incompetence built into bureaucracies. It is a deliberate assault on liberty. Remove a man's living and you leave him no freedom of action, no time to reprove himself or his country. He is ground down by the tax structures and the public debt, almost entirely fictitious, a matter of bookkeeping by interested parties. Figures don't lie, but races are lost to handicappers who overburden the small businessman, the working man, the family farmer, with regulations, financial manipulations, and arbitrary counterproductive taxation. They leave him no redress. He can't vote thieves and oppressors out of office because alternative parties juggle the same books. We are told that we cannot afford this or that necessity because of the balance of functions of government, not to make loan decisions to go to war, to volunteer the lives, the ultimate tax of our defense forces in an offensive war. An offensive war half a world away and against that balance of payments which restricts us but not our government. It is not a function of government to load the dice against any group such as family farmers for inefficiency. There is nothing less efficient than a democratic government. That a family farm can exist despite government is in itself evidence of efficiency. What makes a farm or any other business efficient? The ability to produce. What makes it efficient in the government's view? The ability to furnish reports and statistics to keep within the lines prescribed by unreasonable restrictions, often enough not even legislated, mere departmental policies dictated by some faceless bureaucrat with little or no acquaintance with the reality of the farmer, businessman, or working man. All are subjected to ever-increasing government demands with threats and penalties to fill out forms and furnish data to the government. For whose benefit? Anyone with no time to comply must hire experts to keep books for the government, thus making his operation less efficient or profitable. If the government needs such figures, and governments have functioned for centuries without them, it is the responsibility of the government to produce these figures. If it cannot, it should at least compensate the producer for his lost time, wages, computers, etc., which he must devote to this fruitless mania for unnecessary information. Or is it all for new taxation levies? Is not the producer then required to testify against himself? If he had killed someone, he could refuse. In theory, the most efficient government is local. It addresses local and immediate issues under local and immediate scrutiny. It is not big enough to ignore its constituents. What does our government do for us? Why, it represents us. We vote for our representative, but will he hear us? He goes to his capital and legislates without ceasing because that's what a Congress does. He votes the party line or he'll never see another term in office. The party protects him from his constituents while he merrily slangs the opposition daily with uncreative contumely and inadequate insults. Our situation is covered precisely in that slogan of the American Revolution taxation without representation is tyranny. But somehow procedures have followed and laws flow ceaselessly forth. Each changes something, usually for the worse, and each requires funding at our expense to administer or enforce. Without this tyranny, could we be worse off? Does it defend our shores? Our defenders are overseas. Defending others? The Swiss have the answer to this situation. Every man is given military training, especially in marksmanship, and can be relied upon to bring his weapons if his country is invaded. But governments now engage in weapons confiscation. Law-abiding citizens are disarmed, and only police and criminals can defend themselves. How many cases of breaking and entering would occur if it were known that in every house was a lethal weapon and a man trained in his use? Why not? This confiscatory policy works against defense of the realm and against public order. Who benefits? The tyrant tax collector and his banks, which receive first consideration to the detriment of the taxpayer, and the violent criminal whose rights have been elevated to first charge on our courts. Has anyone ever wondered at the success of the Moorish invasion of Spain? Only 12,000 Moors landed. They overcame the Spanish forces largely due to bribery, but then they simply took over the country. How? The king, Roderick the Goth, because of his tyrannical misrule, feared his own people so much that he had disarmed them. They could defend neither themselves nor their king. In politics, said Franklin Roosevelt, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, it was planned. So it is with our recessions and unemployment. Our government could have virtually wiped out inflation by eliminating tax on fuel and income. Nor would a few cuts in federal giveaways have hurt. But it chose to curb inflation by oppression and duplicity. Is it not oppression to wipe out the remnants of prosperity for any reason? When the avowed purpose is to control inflation, are we not entitled to ask why the government will not curb its own prodigality? Is it not duplicity to encourage the rural sector to become efficient by mechanization at great cost, and then to allow bankers to raise interest out of sight on already existing loans so that these improvements cannot be paid off, and the efficient agrarian is put off his property, which is then operated efficiently by a bank hireling whose own the sheep are not? Is it not duplicity to pull the rug from under industry, allowing inferior foreign products to flood our markets? Is it not outright treason to drive our industries out of the country, thereby making our defense depend upon enemies, real or potential? Is it not oppression and duplicity to let banks prey upon the citizen taxpayer? When one applies for a mortgage to buy a home, the bank or building society assesses to the last cent what repayments he can afford, then raises the interest rate or promotes inflation and steals his home. The government controls everyone but the banks, from which it borrows at usurious interest instead of issuing money without charge, which is one of its major delegated functions. This governmental shirking of its own responsibility creates the federal debt, a major excuse for heavy taxes, a major contribution to inflation. If the federal government were to vanish, who would owe this debt? To whom? Another method of abolishing this fictional, unwarranted, huge debt would be to nationalize the creditor banks, which would create a situation in which the government would owe itself and the debts would cancel out. The income tax is merely a means of control, not to say blackmail, and a major tenet of Marxist policy intended to eliminate class distinctions. It is represented as placing the tax burden fairly. The rich pay more, supposedly. But when the manufacturer is taxed, he raises prices on his goods and services and the poor man pays the rich man's taxes in addition to his own. He is thus ground down for the benefit of others by his own representative government, which exists to protect his rights. In any case, why should a wage earner's income be taxed? He has nothing but his skills and labor to offer. He works for a certain wage, which is what he is worth to his employer, or he would not have been hired. This is a quid pro quo situation in which there is no gain to tax. A man is paid what he and his employers have agreed his work is worth. To tax this even exchange is to put another charge on the entire community. To tax the wage earner is to discriminate against him unless the employer is taxed equally on this no gain quid pro quo contract or arrangement. I've been told that this is a misconception, but I'll go with it. Well, thank you. To take the tax out of wages is to remove it from income, anywhere up to a year and a third before it is owed, and to put another charge on the employer to administer and collect the tax not yet owed, all at his own expense, which he must pass on or inch ever closer to bankruptcy. This comes very close to a tax on the air we breathe, or maybe the water we drink. Is it not at least interesting that the government plans to survive financially without tariffs which protect American producers and jobs, that cannot survive financially without inflationary charges against the whole community? Everyone must tighten his belt except our lavish government, generous to a fault with our money. Whose money? Without the federal government, we should have no federal debt, federal income tax, president, Congress, elections, or courts. We would not belong to the United Nations. UN treaties and conventions would no longer supersede the law of the land. We should not be taxed for foreign aid, nor to pay for huge unnecessary buildings to house federal agencies. We should have no federal monetary system to work with and through the banks, to our great cost. How accomplish this? Secession! Each state withdraws from the fiscal tyranny, boycotts the federal government, repudiates all federal debt and legislation. An entirely new organization could be set up and joined or not by each state for the coinage of money, collection of customs, maintenance of defense forces, a postal system, and the like. Should we secede politically but not financially, we would accomplish little. We have been taught that if a government printed its own money, it would destroy the money's value and cause runaway inflation. But bankers create money out of thin air daily, incidentally creating assets, real property belonging to others, for themselves, and as repayment with interest, combined with income and fuel taxes, have created runaway inflation, plus debt that exceeds all money in existence and can be paid off while this noxious system continues, only with new money created as another debt by the creditor banks themselves. Consider all the centuries without national debts. We need look no further back than 1913. You can't secede, say some. They won't let you. More deplore the great apathy in the political arena. But always see the logic of wiping out the federal debt, of taking home entire salaries, and of paying far less for everything transported except by mule when the price of fuel drops by 50%. All are sick of being taxed for the benefit of foreigners. When third world countries cannot repay huge bank credits, these are written off, and the banks continue to function. They merely create new money to replace that which they created in the first place. They could as easily write off the federal debt. I see no other practical, bloodless means of saving the country and its inhabitants from the banks and the new world order. Nothing else will relieve us of this monstrous public debt. If the government issued its own money and charged only 1% of what the bankers collect for this service, no other tax money would be required for defense or other legitimate expense. The government has forfeited all recognition by working ceaselessly against the interests of the government. It is of absolutely no use to us. To survive, we must abolish it. all agree that the public debt can never be paid off. I will not say repaid, because we receive no benefits for that which we owe all this money. Not real money, but bankers' bookkeeping. It is self-perpetuating through that abuse, a money system existing through profit-making banks rather than through answerable governments. Governments have put themselves and us in the bankers' usurious hands without consulting those who are saddled with the payoffs. These are not our debts. We never assumed them. We are entitled to a governmental debt-free money system. Money is properly nothing more than an instrument of barter. But the banks issue money at usury. Who so empowered the banks? If the government wishes to continue to enrich suppliers of money, which it should itself supply, what is that to us? The government exceeded its competence in relinquishing a delegated power. If I borrow your lawnmower and sell it to my boss, it still belongs to you. If the states delegated the regulation of money to the federal government cannot sell this power to its bosses. It can return only to the delegant. But it will help us not one whit to vote out those men in charge. The debts will remain. We must abolish the debtor, the government itself. If we can't unload the public debt, we shall be next in line behind Brazil and the assets for debt swindle. If we can't unload the UN and its treaties, we shall shortly retain no shadow of freedom. Why should these be matters left to venal politicians or to global plotters? We appreciate all efforts made over the years to rectify matters. But many of our best intentioned and informed have put their whole lives into it, and things continue to worsen. It's time for another approach. Once the killer taxation and permanently cumulative debt vanish, we can afford such things as public transport, hospitals, support for local inventions and industries, etc. We are not independent of the United Nations. This huge step on the road to one world government and new world order, which responds to the will of the majority, made up largely of savages and tyrannies incapable of running their own countries, so our government puts us at their service. At a trial in 1798, Justice Samuel Chase observed, quote, "The nature and ends of legislative power limit the exercise of it. This fundamental principle flows from the very nature of our free republican governments, that no man should be compelled to do what the laws do not require, nor to refrain from acts which the laws permit. There are acts which the federal or state legislatures cannot do without exceeding their authority. There are certain vital principles in our free republican governance which will determine and overrule an apparent and flagrant abuse of legislative power as to authorize manifest injustice by positive law, or take away that security for personal liberty or private property for the protection whereof the government was established." End of quotation. I quote this last paragraph from John Remington Graham's A Constitutional History of Secession. I continue to quote from the same page 95. The same idea of a republican form of government was given another rich expression in the venerable case of Van Horn's Lessee versus Dorrance, U.S. Circuit Court, Pennsylvania, 1795, in which Justice William Patterson instructed the jury, quote, "What is the Constitution? It is the form of government delineated by the mighty hand of the people, in which certain first principles of fundamental law are established. The Constitution is certain and fixed. It contains the permanent will of the people and is the supreme law of the land. It is paramount to the will of the legislature and can be revoked or altered only by the authority that made it. The life-giving principle and the death stroke must proceed from the same hand." What are legislatures? Creatures of the Constitution. They owe their existence to the Constitution. They derive their powers from the Constitution. It is their commission, and therefore all their acts must be conformable to it, or else they will be void. The Constitution is the work of the people themselves in their original, sovereign, and unlimited capacity. Law is the work of the legislature in their derivative and subordinate capacity. The one is the work of the Creator, the other of the creature. In short, gentlemen, the Constitution is the sun of the political system around which all legislative, executive, and judicial bodies must revolve. End of quotation. It could not be clearer. The government and all its branches are creatures of the Constitution from which they derive their existence and their powers. And the Constitution itself draws its power from the people. I hate to change the subject. A quote from the Douay Bible. John 19:11. Jesus answered, "Thou shouldst not have any power against me unless it were given thee from above." Romans 13:1. "Let every soul be subject to higher powers. For there is no power but from God and those that are ordained of God." Daniel 4:23. "Thy kingdom shall remain to thee after thou shalt have known that power is from heaven." Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it," etc. Power, then, resides in the people, who derive it from God. What is the balance of payments? Who owes what to whom? Is there a nation without a positive balance? Why should it affect our interest rates or concern us in any way? Money is spent for value received, except taxes and interest, which surely create an imbalance. When has a lowering of living standards or loss of prosperity in a developed country benefited an underdeveloped country? If the plutocrat next door is bankrupted, what's in it for me? If my college professors fall suddenly into senility, my tennis coach turns spastic, termites chew up my Stradivarius, and my children go blind, who benefits? If I can sing and Corelli can sing better, if he is paid and I am not, my nose remains unskinned. I can still sing, or I used to. Is God obliged to distribute his gifts to his or his oil equally? When all those Australian sheep were slaughtered, did famine-ridden Ethiopia starve less? If New York City's water supply is cut off, are living conditions for Saharans thereby improved? When Joe's house burns, is homeless Jim closer to finding shelter? When meat was rationed during World War II to feed the troops, did we eat higher on the hog? When a steak was served, we smelled combat. The condemned conscripts, fighting other people's wars, ate a hearty dinner or two. Paradoxically, the further away a government, the greater its interference in private affairs. It seems in the nature of strong federal governments that they encroach continuously upon fresh areas. Counties and municipalities seldom dream of the control taken for granted by the state, which is in turn only an amateur compared with the national government. The bigger the stick, the heavier its application, and the faceless federal bureaucrat need never face his victim. Above and beyond all these tiers of regulators are the real government, the banks. Governments support the banks in every way, even to enforcing unjust claims against the citizenry, the guarding of whose rights is the government's primary purpose. Uncounted primary producers have been driven off their lands by this alliance of government and banks. If the government refuses to protect you, you must protect yourself. Neither the bank nor its tool, the government, is lord of life and death. That is only how it works out, as the suicide rate shows. Suicide is the ultimate despair. It is unforgivable in that it allows no chance of repentance, unless it is badly botched. If the intended suicide, however, used his weapon with equal effect in the office of a bank executive, he might survive long enough in jail to work up repentance. Luckily, perhaps, suicides are not noted for logic, and alternatives exist. Youngstown, Ohio, has steel mills which paid taxes to a federal government which donated their tax money to brand new steel mills in underdeveloped regions. These new mills, supported by instead of supporting the U.S. government, competed with American steel mills sufficiently to close down many, even at Youngstown. This threw many out of work, too old to find other work, even had it been available in a steel mill town. Many had worked 25 years or more, but not quite long enough to have paid off their mortgages. When you pay 20 or 25 years on a 30-year mortgage, you have repaid much more than the face value of your original mortgage. But the banks had not lost their jobs, so they foreclosed on very good and reliable customers whose living had evaporated through government interference. So the court issued the eviction notices prepared in the bank's interest. But Sheriff Jim Traficant refused to serve them. He went to jail for contempt of court because he would neither resign nor serve these criminal notices. Another alternative is that attempted by a Queensland farmer, deprived of justice in the courts because his opponent was a bank. His secession documents disclose the iniquity, but even more they demonstrate the erosion of our rights by the governments constituted to preserve them. He presented excellent reasons for seceding, but they boil down to, whereas both state and federal governments have failed to secure and protect the citizens' rights according to legal enactments, common law, and natural law, and have placed their law enforcement bodies, one of whose major purposes and duties is to protect the aforesaid rights of the citizen, at the service of criminal usury against the aforesaid rights of the citizen, in consequence, therefore, to secure and protect our civil rights under common, positive, and natural law, we secede, etc. According to Julie Foster on WorldNetDaily.com, an Arizona legislative committee approved a resolution calling for dissolution of the federal government in the event that it abolishes the U.S. Constitution. Hasn't done this? Declares martial law or confiscates firearms. House Concurrent Resolution 2034 outlined the origin of the United States, emphasizing the sovereignty of the states and their constitutional right to, quote, establish a new federal government by following the precedent established by Article 7, Constitution of the United States, in which 9 of the existing 13 states dissolved the existing union under the Articles of Confederation and automatically superseded these articles. Close articles. Unquote. It cited federal violations. Quote, the 50 current principles or signatories to the Constitution have done well in honoring or obeying it, yet the federal agent has for decades violated it in both word and spirit, to include disposing of federal property without approval of Congress, usurping jurisdiction in such matters as abortion and firearms rights, and seeking control of public lands within state borders. Unquote. This article points out a logical deficiency in the Arizona program. Quote, each state will assume a prorated portion of the national debt. Good job. Unquote. The aim is dissolution of the federal government. The national debt belongs, thank you, to the federal government. Whatever belongs to the federal government shares its dissolution. If it is dissolved, it cannot sell even its buildings. Perhaps they will belong to history or to some Delaware corporation. According to Professor Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, during World War I, the ratio of gold reserves to notes fell in France from 60 to 11%, in Germany from 59 to 10%, in Russia, which had no public debt, from 98 to 2%, in Italy from 60 to 13%, in Britain from 52 to 32%. But why is money based on metal rather than on gross national product? Because grain or wool are consumed or spoiled? So are munitions. But don't they grow again next year? Are they not of more use than the inert metal in insufficient quantity? Bankers have assets, not least of which are mortgages held on real property in exchange for credit created from thin air. Since it is physically impossible for all borrowers to repay out of money available, bankers inevitably acquire title to real property, which costs them only what it takes to buy off the government, which permits them to assume the governmental functions of creation and control of money. Government exists for the general good, to secure the rights of their people. Governments exist to secure the rights of their people, not for the protection of bankers and their tyranny. If fire or flood destroy a mortgage property, why have they no effect on the banker? He protects his customers and investors. He lies through his teeth. Rather, he destroys his possibility, uncertain by nature, of eventual repayment. But this suits the government, even though it loses another taxpayer in the process. So who works for whom? Who needs or can survive such a government? So read the documents. Discover how little the government in signing United Nations treaties and declarations regards rights it has itself guaranteed. Efficient, responsible government is likeliest at the local level. Everything possible should be handled at that level. Federal law should not overcome local law. Local law preceded and should overcome federal law. This is how our Constitution was set up. To restrict federal functions to those few specifically conceded and delegated for the common good by the states. If the federal government gives away any of the functions granted by the several states, the states have the natural right to repossess these functions and themselves exercise them, as in coinage and issue of money, or in maintenance of troops for defense of the state or the country. The federal government, moreover, has no right to surrender delegated rights to anyone other than the delegating authority. Our entire public monetary system is based on a palpable fraud. Though we suffered an unnecessary and disastrous war over states' rights, it is clear that states voluntarily entering the Union had the right voluntarily to exit. The war settled only who won by force of numbers and supplies, not the issue. If a state wills, as is its plain duty, to protect the lives of its unborn, it has an absolute moral right to set aside or ignore statutes or rulings to the contrary of any and all federal agencies and courts. Our mythical separation of church and state appears to restrict only the church. The Supreme Court is not competent to overrule God's law. Nor may it set up and protect. Let me get this straight. Privileged classes of extortionists in the guise of tax collectors and legal murderers in the guise of healers, such as abortionists and euthanasiologists. Like the rest of the federal government, it is our servant, not our master. It derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. Formerly, mistreatment of an American or British citizen abroad carried with it the risk of war and other sanctions. Now various federal governments introduce restrictions on their citizenry by the simple expedient of signing treaties with the United Nations. Our federal government exceeds its limited powers in subjecting us to this or any other foreign power, legitimate or not. All states can and should nullify any act of the federal government which usurps functions never specifically delegated by the states. Local government is most efficient at least partly because its people are on the scene and constitute a threat to an ill-run administration. We are not all on the federal scene. it is extremely difficult to reform a president or a Supreme Court. But we all have state governors who are much easier to impress with their sworn duty. We can even on occasion recall them from office. California has done so within living memory. Let the governors insist on their constituents' rights. If necessary, let them secede from the federal government. Let no federal court operate within their respective states. Let no federally chartered banks operate within their states. Let no federal agency operate. No FCC, no BATF, no ICC, no Homeland Security, no FEMA, no IRS. No health, education, and welfare. Let them shut down federal prisons. Let them recover the vast areas stolen by the federal government and investigate how they are used. Let them introduce their own money. Let federal law apply only in the District of Columbia and the territories. And then let Maryland and Virginia, if they can be persuaded, recover the useless District of Columbia. The federal government will not take us lying down, but the lines will be clearly drawn. We shall all see who own the federal government and to what measures they will drive it. Our time is running out. We can never hope to recover control of the government by an electoral process. Voting machines and computers are too easy to rig. It costs too much to run for office. Most winners owe their election to their party. They will not win again without the party's backing. Ideally, we should outlaw the party system, but the time for that may have been 2 centuries ago. In past times, we were presented a choice. Some of us can remember believing that we had a choice. But each passing generation remembers less. If we do nothing, we cannot bank on our descendants to supply our deficiencies. We shall only continue to accelerate our slide into the ever-deepening quicksand. Secession is our likeliest method to recover our freedom bloodlessly. Our continued enslavement will not be bloodless. Tyrants rule by terror, which since the French Revolution has best been promoted by mass unprovoked slaughter. Thank you.
Don't leave. Okay? Don't leave just yet.
Okay.
We'll straighten it out. Yeah, you got some of ours. I'll straighten it out with you. Hang on just a second.
Hey, Alex!
We've just had more truth that I don't think any of that I know I have ever received in one dose. The talking heads were talking before the president's State of the Union message earlier this week. And what is it, they said, you know, does he have to do? And they said, he has to be a visionary. Here's the visionary. More truth and far more applause interruptions than we saw and heard Tuesday night from the president. I believe this is Lou Rockwell's mentor. And he certainly ought to be Aaron Russo's running mate, at least. What a team that would make. I'd like to request, we've decided at the foundation that we'd like to set up an advisory board, and I'd like to invite you to give serious consideration to being the first member of our new advisory board. Thank you. This has been a watershed moment in my life. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.